Well, I want to welcome you to our privacy panel this morning. The title is There is No Free Lunch, and one of our panelists just pointed out maybe it wasn't such a good idea to have that title during the lunch hour. So I'm sorry there isn't a lunch here today to share with you. My name is Diane McDade, and I'm the Director of Policy and Privacy for the Windows Live MSN services at Microsoft. And I've been active in the privacy world for a number of years, dating back to 1998 when I joined Microsoft. And we just want to spend some time this afternoon with our distinguished panelists, having, we hope, a spirited discussion and sort of a discussion about ethics. So this is a break from development work. And we also would like to leave lots of time at the end for audience questions. So please save those up for us. And we'll take probably the last quarter or so of the session. We'll focus on your questions. I want to begin by introducing our panelists. To my left is Trevor Hughes. And Trevor Hughes is the executive director of the Network Advertising Initiative. It's popularly known as NAI. And this is the organization that focuses on engendering trust in the online advertising space, particularly in the third-party advertising world. His members are focused on consumer protection and privacy issues. And in that organization, they have all the major players in the online advertising, third-party advertising world as member groups. Trevor's had a long-time interest in privacy. He also is the executive director of the IAPP, which is the Association of Privacy Professionals. And he is a Canadian by birth, but lives in York, Maine. Next to him, we have our distinguished panelist, Andrew Rashbaugh. And Andrew comes from the UK. He is the publisher of The Economist, a journal which I'm sure all of you have spent a lot of time reading. If not on planes, I hope you subscribe to it. It's a wonderful publication. And he has spent a long career in journalism. He's responsible at The Economist for all the commercial aspects of that publication outside of the editorial department itself, and has been associated with in other capacities in the journalistic community in the UK for a number of years. To my far left is Mark Hedlund. And Mark is the co-founder and the chief product officer for Wasabi. Wasabi is a startup that is how old?
About a year and a half.
About a year and a half. And it's a very successful firm that is in this area of aggregating financial data. And as such, Wasabi is a leader in the online privacy space. They've recently issued a privacy bill of rights, which you're going to hear more about today. And Mark has had a long history of involvement with startups and was also with Lucas Online and helped launch some of the online activity around Star Wars. So you can ask him about that later if you're interested in hearing more. But all of our panelists share one thing in common, which is they've spent an uncommonly a lot of time and long history in thinking about privacy. And each of them is considered what we might say to be a thought leader in this area. They have very sometimes converging, but somewhat different points of view on this subject, and that's what we want to do today, is spend a little bit of time just exploring the different areas as the online privacy debate grows a little bit fiercer. It's been in the news a lot recently, and I think it will continue on. I think, just to start off, I wanted to just focus on the fact that we're here in Las Vegas, and as far as I know, it's the only municipality in the world whose official trade slogan involves privacy. As we all know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. And I find it a little bit ironic because in reality, I don't know how many of you are active gamblers. I'm not, but I know some. When you're in Vegas, in reality, if you're a member of the special clubs, of the active gambling clubs, they're tracking everything you do from the moment you make your reservation. They give you a special airline rate to when you check in. You have your card, and you are watched every transaction that's made on the gambling tables or in the restaurants. And they really do target you, and they turn around and use that data very specifically to encourage you to come back many times to Vegas. And when we talk about a free lunch, I know years ago, they had almost the equivalent of free lunches here in Vegas. They had very, 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 very inexpensive meals to keep the gamblers right here, didn't have to leave the building. And so I just wanted my panelists, this is a little trick, they're going to be a little surprised, but I want to ask them their opinion of that slogan and what it means and why Las Vegas has adopted it. I'll start with you.
Gosh. I think the slogan speaks to the
the sort of lascivious nature of Las Vegas, that what happens in Vegas needs to stay in Vegas because we'd all be very embarrassed if it got out. So while the marketing aspect of being surveilled while you do everything here is very important to note, it's also important to note that Vegas would fail as a concept if the fact that you went to a strip club, the fact that you blew your rent money, your mortgage money for the year at the gambling tables, the fact that you did all sorts of things that you might be embarrassed about back in your hometown, if that got out, the concept of Vegas would fail because no one would come here. People come here because they expect and need some degree of, well, privacy with regards to their lives. And so that's why I think they have the slogan. And it is sort of a dichotomy, and we could probably use this theme throughout the panel today with everything that we talk about in terms of web privacy, that we do all sorts of things that we're embarrassed about, and that involves enormous amounts of data, but we need to draw some lines about how we use that data and where it gets shared and where it gets disclosed.
Anybody else want to comment on that?
I think it's there's clearly that side. I think there is a different side, though, which is that... it's also an acceptance that it's okay to have compartments in your life. And I think that does speak to privacy. But I do think that part of it is kind of saying you can come to Vegas and, I don't know whether you quite call it lascivious, but you can gamble and you can do other things and it doesn't make you a bad person. It doesn't mean that you're going to I go back, in my case, and, you know, put all this year's earnings on red. I don't think that those two things follow. So I think there is a more positive spin to it than simply the expectation that everyone here is up to nefarious activities that need to be kept secret.
Well, so the other side of it, of course, is that one of the big fears of privacy advocates is that these databases sort of accumulate over time. And I imagine that if what has happened in Vegas has stayed in Vegas for many years, that they probably have very extensive databases about regular visitors. And that's maybe not a big concern for this panel, but I think that when we look at some of the web applications that are collecting so much data about what you're doing, what happens on Google stays on Google might not be such a successful marketing slogan for people who are searching for embarrassing information.
Mm-hmm. Well, the premise of our panel today is that most consumers don't actually have a full understanding of the fact that a lot of the internet services that they use and that are so popular that all of us use are actually subsidized by advertising, and that they are, in fact, making a trade when they utilize those services and share information with them, even if it's just as benign as this company just tracking the searches that you've made inquiries on, even if you're not exposing more information. And so one of the things we want to talk a little bit about today is what does that really mean? Do consumers understand that there's a trade-off, that advertisers are collecting data? Do they care? Is it a competitive differentiation? And just to get that conversation underway, I wanted to ask Mark to explain a little bit about his firm, Wasabi, which is collecting a vast amount of information, very personal information about all the purchases that you make, whether it's online or offline, and talk a little bit about why he thinks that is an area that's okay to put online, all of your purchase history, and tell us the reason why, and tell us why you believe that the privacy is protected for your customers.
Sure. So the theory behind Wasabi is that there are many, many, many more consumers in the world than there are businesses. But as a consumer, when you walk into a business, let's say an auto dealership, what the auto dealership knows about you is this huge amount of information, how much money you make, who your roommates are, whether you pay your bills on time, what magazines you subscribe to, maybe your political and religious affiliation. On the other hand, if you try and get information about that auto dealership, what you have available to you is relatively paltry. You can see 1 to 5 star ratings, maybe. You can see some reviews that have been written online. But that's pretty much it. You don't really have a big well of information that you can go to say, well, is this dealership a better value for my money than this other dealership or this type of car or whatever? So the idea of Wasabi is to say, credit bureaus have been a big benefit to businesses where they track how consumers behave once they're issued credit. And Wasabi is sort of the reverse idea, the idea of saying, like, well, let's have a value bureau for consumers so you can look at a particular business and say, if I give this business my money, am I going to get good value from it or am I going to get screwed? So, you know, the ways that we try and do that are by saying, you know, we give you money management tools, like a very simple version of Quicken or Microsoft Money, to allow you to kind of get a better view into your data than your bank website gives you. And then we say, okay, here are tips from the community about how you can get more for your money, places you can shop or techniques you can use, or ideas for just not spending money in the first place. And then we take all of the data that people are managing through that interface and we try and pull information out of it. So we can say, hey, there's this new restaurant in Las Vegas and 100 Wasabi members went there and none of them ever went back. They all just stopped going after that. Or here's this other restaurant where 100 Wasabi members went and then next week 90 of them came back or 50 of them came back. We can look at that and say, okay, restaurant A probably sucks. This is probably not a great restaurant. And restaurant B is probably really good. You know, there's probably a lot of reason why people are coming back. So when we see all those pieces of data together, we can pull out information that allows consumers to get more from their money and figure out where to spend their money. So obviously the big risk in this is, you know, as the question is asking, is, you know, is it okay for me to manage my money online? You know, there's a reason why Quicken is maybe the last great desktop holdout application that nobody's really successfully put onto the web. So the approach that we've taken is to say there are a bunch of technological things we can do to protect your privacy. One of them is we never ask you for your bank username or password. We have a downloadable client that keeps that information on your hard drive because we don't think you should have to put it into a website. And another approach we take is a policy approach to say, hey, we're going to guarantee you a bill of rights for what we do with your data. And number one on that Bill of Rights is if you ever want to, you can export your data from Wasabi and delete it from the Wasabi servers. Most people who are trying to aggregate data will never let you delete that data off of their hard drives, and we believe that it's better to allow people to delete it. So why do we believe that? When I started thinking about this business, I went around and talked to about 1,500 people in as many different walks of life as I could about their relationship to money, tools they use to manage money, things like that. And I heard one thing really consistently, which was that people knew that there was a problem, but they didn't understand what the problem was. They knew that there was a threat to their privacy. Identity theft was a problem. Somebody could come in and take my bank credentials. That seemed scary. But they really didn't know how to evaluate those problems. It wasn't clear, you know, I get these emails from my bank and I get these letters from my bank and I don't know what they mean, but really it just freaks me out and I'm really not very happy about it. So we asked them, well, how would you make a decision about this? And most of them said, well, I would talk to my friend Jonah over there because Jonah's really techie and he's a great guy and he would tell me whether this is safe or not. So we looked at that and we thought, okay, we have to convince the Jonas of the world that this is right, the early adopters of the world that this is right. And that approach has really, really worked for us. The early adopters of the world have been really happy with the Bill of Rights and the technology protections we've put in place. And as a result, we've had over $400 million worth of transaction data uploaded to the site since November, which is pretty great. Like, that's much more successful than any of the Quicken competitor sort of web companies have ever done before.
So, Andrew, I want to ask you, you have a website that collects data, and you track the economist users, and you try to maximize their advertising on your site. Why do you not have a privacy bill of rights for your consumers?
Well, we have a very clear statement, but I think it's different to what Mark's talking about because, you know, the example that Mark gave, which everyone's worried about and nobody understands the technology, is to do with people stealing your financial information. So, you know, we all know the issues about phishing and everything else. And I think you have to distinguish between data and worries that relate to criminal activities, identity theft, credit card theft, and ones that are to do with legitimate, explicit, and actually consistent with everything that's been going on in the offline world for generations, marketing activity. And I would add the third thing that we were talking about earlier. You've also got this fundamental thing about privacy, which relates to very strong in this country, but also in other parts of the world as well, worries about what the government might do with your data if they put it all together. So you've got this government worry about freedom and relation to privacy. You've got this criminal worry. And then you've got this worry about marketing activity. And my view is that actually consumers are fairly savvy on the marketing front. and that they are not too concerned about it, and that I think it's unfair and patronizing to consumers to think that they don't understand, but also it is scaremongering to take the worries about people stealing your credit card details and your bank passwords and everything else and going out and cleaning out your bank account and applying that to the sorts of behavioral targeting that I think is just part and parcel of marketing.
So I would add a fourth category just quickly, which is embarrassment. I mean, I think that there is a real and legitimate concern about, well, if I just put down my credit card at either something like we were talking about earlier, like a porn site, and I don't want that to be online for any reason, whether it's marketing or anything else, I just don't feel comfortable having that online. Or whether it's something that has more direct impact, like, hey, I'm buying AIDS-related medications, and I don't want that transaction online either. Both of those are things that I think cause a different kind of fear than the categories you mentioned.
I would concur wholeheartedly with Andrew that it's a logical fallacy to suggest that the ID theft concerns and the government concerns associated with privacy, government access to data, that somehow those leapfrog over into the marketing world and the behavioral targeting world. I don't think they do. Although I would disagree just a bit, I think, on the consumer response, because I think there is a difference in the online world for whatever reason. I am a soccer fan, and I get soccer catalogs in the mail, and I like getting soccer catalogs in the mail, and I know that I'm being targeted all the time with soccer catalogs because I buy from them, and somewhere there's a database that shows that I'm making purchases from those soccer catalogs. I'm not a quilter, and I don't get any quilting catalogs. There is a discipline and a logic that exists within the offline world. In the online world, I think people struggle with the transparency of the system a bit more, and there are bigger concerns in the online world associated with behavior being observed in one place. Perhaps it's a site that you'd be embarrassed about, and that data being used to target you somewhere else. Certainly we've seen those concerns emerge in the media. Certainly we've seen them emerge with privacy advocates. There's one other layer to this, and it's sort of the embarrassment factor. We talk to our members a lot about the use of sensitive data, and what is sensitive data, and when does that concern emerge, and it's very, very difficult to put your finger on. It's almost like the Supreme Court definition of pornography. You know it when you see it. It's sort of that oogie factor. You know, if it's a cancer drug and they're trying to target people who have done cancer searches, and they're doing that across a broad network of sites, they're sending now cancer pharmaceutical ads, there's some concerns in the marketplace associated with that. There is a reaction to that that I think we ignore at our peril because it will come around and bite us if we don't.
I mean, yeah, to follow up on that, I just want to ask, Mark talked about the concept of data portability, that on his site you can enter all your transactional data and then you can later pick up your marbles and go home and it will all be erased out of the Wasabi database entirely. I wonder, when we think about other types of transactions, whether or not that's something, when you get into sensitive data, that consumers ought to be able to look to see what their profile is that's been developed and then remove or decommission their access to that data. Is that something that's being discussed today? Do consumers have that ability to do that?
So I can tell you that access is one of the hottest issues in the behavioral targeting world. It is incredibly difficult to do, to compile that log file data, that traffic data into a dossier and provide access to it. And then more than that, provide the ability to delete it, manage it, work it through. It is, though, from privacy advocates, one of the most frequently requested features. Mark Rotenberg from Epic, one of the leading advocates in the privacy world, bangs his fist on the table saying, why can't we get access to these profiles? Why can't we get access to these targeted behavior dossiers?
Right. All three of you are experts on cookies. And today, cookie management is one of the ways that consumers are able to manage. It's a crude way to manage, but it's a way to manage these kinds of issues on the on the web today. Do we think that we're ever going to advance beyond that, that there will be more fine-grained controls than cookie management? Do we think that day is coming?
Well, I'm sure it is. And to me, that's... if you take a simple example of marketing, which is the pop-up, how many people here, I mean, obviously this is quite a techie audience, but how many people here block pop-ups? Does anyone not block pop-ups, for those who can't be bothered to put their hands up? No, you see, we all block pop-ups. Those people who invested in, if you said my only marketing technique is pop-ups, you're kind of out of business. Those who used to send spam email, I mean, there's still clearly a lot of spam email. Who has spam filters? Everyone's got spam filters, right? Now, the your association has DoubleClick and others as members. Mm-hmm. I haven't done technology for a while, but you're all techie, so you can tell me if this is right. If you go and use Firefox, as I do, and potentially IE as well, you can go and get an ad blocker. You go and you can download a set of filters for that. If you just take some sort of, you know, star, DoubleClick star, you will block out all DoubleClick ads. And not only will you block them out, the way the technology works, as I understand it, is that that add-on is actually interrogating the code before it makes the call to the server. Is that correct? And therefore, effectively, the server will never know that you were on a site that was due to serve that ad. And that means that if that became prevalent, which would take, I guess, Microsoft to ship it as standard with IE, but if Microsoft decided that it wanted to do that, kind of DoubleClick would virtually be out of business overnight.
Yeah, I think, you know, them's fighting words. I think that ad blockers fundamentally destroy the economic model upon which the web is based. So, now, pop-ups, I would agree, they pissed us all off, and so nobody is mourning the death of pop-ups. But ad blockers as a tool to block the delivery of advertising seems to me to be a mistake. What we do have, though, already in IE7 are cookie management tools that require the attachment of a compact privacy policy to any third-party cookie in order for that cookie to actually be read or set in IE7. And you can raise or lower your privacy preferences within the browser and really manage cookies. So you still get the ad, but you don't get the
target. But my point is, it's effectively market forces. I make money selling advertising, well, so I don't want to stop it.
That's not fair, because you're absolutely right that that's true for cookies that exist on my browser mm-hmm. and for the information that I'm receiving, such as ads. But none of that applies to data that's stored on a server. I don't know what data is necessarily stored. I don't have any way of deleting it. And you know, certainly you're right that in the case of targeted ads, you can probably get rid of the ad if you don't want to see it. The intrusion is probably very slight. But in the case of, say, search histories, which are used to develop targeted ads, I don't know of any company in the search space that allows you to see what the profile is or delete it or anything along those lines. So I think that things that are stored on the server are probably a different kind of...
So here's the next generation issue that I think is fascinating, and that is that, you know, the one pivot point for the past 10-plus years has been the cookie. The cookie has been our state management tool for the delivery of all of these advertisements, and it has been that junction point upon which we can put controls like those that exist in the IE7 browser and Firefox and Safari and others. But we're increasingly seeing, as we move towards static IP addresses, that static IP targeting can be used as a state management device. And sure. One has to imagine, as we move forward with IPv6 and other things, that that maybe the utility of the cookie as a state management tool will somehow pass and will actually go to IP address as your state management function. And if we go there, you know, then the gig's up, kind of, because your IP address is your IP address. You kind of need that in order for everything to work. And if that is your targeting mechanism, that creates real challenges.
Except that, you know, the technology for spoofing IPs and various other things is there if people were interested enough. It's rather like in the case of credit cards. You can go now and buy prepaid credit cards. So you can go to the store, put your $300 down, get your credit card, which has a number, go to your porn site, and buy your anonymous porn if you care enough about that. So I would argue that actually these technologies, I mean, because of the fundamental simplicity of the internet architecture compared with the old days, actually there is, you know, if you take the community here, their ability to create ways to outfox the marketing community's ability to track, I would put the money on technologists
every day.
The question is there money in it? Is there a business? And even,
it doesn't even have to be in business, because in the days of open source and everything else, everyone's working for nothing, rather frighteningly. So it's absolutely the case that if there is the market demand, all the technology that's required, they're off to go and write it now, you see. All the technology that's required for stopping all this tracking is there. And therefore, I would argue that because the capabilities are always there, and because people are not doing it, my conclusion from that is that actually there is not an issue here.
Well, I think that's right. And certainly we have seen IP anonymizing services and technologies emerge, proxies that allow you to hide within a group of people so that you're not targeted in the same way. The point I want to make, though, is that if we look at cookie churn rates, cookie delete rates, cookie block rates, they're very, very high. Consumers are actually using those tools today. And IP addresses are perhaps a more fundamental mechanism within our current architecture, and it is absent, again, those anonymizing technologies or proxy technologies. It's more difficult for us to erase IP addresses as a state management tool.
I think it's actually the same thing. I mean, I agree with you that there's a difference there, that I can delete a cookie from a search engine or an ad network, but I can't delete an IP address record from the same area. So I agree that there's a difference. But really, all that the opposing side would have to do would be to reacquire some identity that they could associate with the prior profile. So if I log into one account and I use some email and a cookie is set, and then I do a day's work or a week's work, and then I delete cookies, and then I go back and log in again, then that second set of behavior can be associated with the first set of behavior, because it's all stored on the server side. So whether it's IP address or cookie-based, it doesn't really matter. As long as I can reacquire the user at some point, then I'm able to see, okay, this set of behavior is matched with this set of behavior.
You know, if we pick up on what Trevor said, that consumers are out there constantly flushing out their cookies, and I've heard those reports consistently over time, then it suggests that that is the control people are aware of that they can use to create more privacy around them. And most consumers don't have the technical maybe interest, I would posit, in going out and getting anonymizers and understanding how to use them. The vast majority of people aren't exposed to those and don't understand how they work. So I'm wondering, are people looking for more anonymity? Are people looking for ways to be private? And what would happen if they found out that the free services that they've been using for so long simply would not survive without their participation in sharing that data, whether they're doing it sort of in a way that's comfortable for them or just in a way that they say, well, I have to give it up in order to use the service. So, Trevor, has anybody ever done a calculation of the value of all of these treat-free services to the consumer? I mean, do we know what it would cost to provide these services if people had needed to subscribe or pay directly?
So I haven't seen that data specifically, but we're actually trying to dig it up, and if we can't find it, we'll be trying to learn it in the next few months within the NAI, because certainly the free content and services on the web today, there is no free lunch. It's getting paid for somewhere, and most often it is being paid for in the online advertising world. If you look at the Interactive Advertising Bureau, one of the trade associations that represents and does metrics and standardization for the online advertising world, you know, they're talking about a marketplace that's about $40 billion. So if we were to take that number and subtract out agencies, subtract out service providers, and expect that some percentage of that is going to websites, to publishers to support content and services, you know, it's a fairly big number, I think, that we're talking about in terms of the dollar value in the U.S. Of free content and services that's being supported.
Another possibility is that people simply can't understand. They look at the privacy statements, and there's a big problems with transparency and comprehensibility. I did a little check. There's a little known feature in Word of all of your privacy statements and their comprehensibility. And I'm going to start with NAI. Your privacy statement has only 402 words, which is really impressive. And it is for a 10th grade level audience can understand it, which is really quite good. Over at The Economist, you have 1,230 words, and you need a graduate... you need 2 years of college, 14 years
well,
of education
the Economist,
to read your privacy statement. And then at Wasabi, you had 446 words. All of these are remarkably short. They're literally, like, I commend you. And you need 12 years just out of high school to follow your privacy statement. But I dare say if you ran the MSN one, the one I've written, it's way higher.
How many words is it?
Well, I went off our top layer, which is the first thing the consumer sees, and it's 377 words. And that comprehension level is almost, it's 11 years of college, almost 12,
11.9. No,
11 years of school. It's school, excuse me. But if you dug into our lower level, because that layer notice that we have is just a top level, and then you could click down to read all the dirty details, it's way, way beyond. I didn't even go there.
I think that the statistics are interesting, but I basically think that I'm a privacy advocate and I don't read privacy policies. Right. Like the only time I ever see it come up is when there's a real question about a company's intent and one expert goes in and parses the privacy policy and tries to figure out what they say. So at that point, the reading comprehension level of the policy doesn't really matter. It's essentially a lawyer looking at a legal document and rendering an opinion about that. And, it's great that those statements are there, but I don't think they help consumers.
So how can consumers understand the transaction that they're engaged in of giving data and what the company's doing? How can we get around this?
There's interesting research on this from Pew Internet and Family Life also a professor named Eric Johnson from Carnegie Mellon University. Pew Internet has told us that consumers don't read privacy policies, sort of period, end of story. They're written by lawyers and they're used in litigation later and read by lawyers later. I mean, Graham Leach Bliley in the offline world is the financial services privacy law. Every year all of us have to get a privacy statement in one of our monthly account statements. How many have actually read one? Yeah, I mean, and my hand's only up because I've read one, and it was an exercise in my own ego because I wrote it, and I pulled it out, and I said, honey, look, I wrote this. I don't read them. I don't read them. And if you haven't read them, that means that none of you have opted out of the one thing that you can opt out of. So not only are you not reading them, but you're not engaging in the choice tools that are made available to you through privacy policies. So we know that the consumer engagement with privacy policies is tremendously, tremendously low. So it raises this question, well, what do we do? How do we convey privacy information or information about how a company is going to use data to a consumer? Eric Johnson is a professor who has done research on the power of defaults, that consumers really want to trust you. Consumers really want to have a recommendation from you about what they should do. If you're asking them, do you want to opt into our newsletter, they want you to tell them, yes, opt into our newsletter. If you want them to say, we'll share your information with trusted third parties, tell them, yes, you should share your data with third parties. Now, the important word in everything that I just said is trust. Consumers have to trust you in order for them to feel comfortable with engaging in that relationship and taking your recommendation. So the default that you set for consumers, the way that you guide them through your service or your site, is incredibly important. And engendering trust with them, giving them all sorts of indicators from all over your site that they can trust you, is really going to help you in terms of how you create a lasting relationship with that customer.
I did want to say one thing about what you had said earlier, that that it was, I think, correct me if I'm misquoting you, but I think you had said it was condescending.
Was it a good comment? It was a good comment.
It was condescending people to say that they didn't understand the trade-offs, and yep. I really think that they don't, and I think the evidence is right here where we are arguing about what the trade-offs are for cookie deletion or IP addresses, and we as four privacy experts have disputes about it. How can we expect a user to understand it? And I think the real evidence is in the AOL search data leak that happened, I think it was last year, many very savvy web technologists that I knew were shocked to see this history of data that was associated with a single person talking about very private details, even though they know a lot about the web and they know a lot about how it works. But the people that I knew at Google and Yahoo were like, well, yeah, I mean, we see this all the time. This is what people use search engines for all the time. And I think that gap really explains
This is an analogy, really. It's not an example. But
if you take environmentalism, the science behind carbon pollution is extremely complicated, and there are, among experts, big debates about whether or not what exactly has the impact. But consumers do absolutely have a broad understanding that allows them to say, do I care? And broadly, they know the kinds of choices they can make to reduce their carbon footprint. They don't have to, of course, to say, because scientists can't get a complete agreement about exactly the impact of carbon on the environment, therefore, the average consumer doesn't stand a chance. I don't think that's right at all. I think actually it's the other way around. We're sitting here talking about cookies and various other things, and that's great. But actually, I think consumers do broadly understand the trade-offs that they make. And absolutely, you know, when if you go in the offline world, you take the loyalty cards and loyalty programs, and you're all sitting there, you know, giving in your cards to get your air miles or at your supermarkets or whatever it is that you're subscribing to. You know what you're doing. You know you're giving data. You know you're building loyalty.
I agree.
And you're doing it in order to get your air miles or to get your supermarket points. So, and in the case of Google, I mean, Google have done a fantastic job along the right-hand side, and I suspect many of us, particularly when we're in purchase mode, use the right-hand side, you know, the paid-for links, as much, if not more, than we use the search links. And the thought that, you know, Google isn't using what we've typed to make that case, you know, would destroy the whole utility that we're getting out of it.
Well, so I think that the point at which consumers really understand it is sort of like a plumbing problem, where nobody cares about the plumbing until it breaks. It's the same sort of thing with privacy questions like this. If I were to say to you, you know, are you comfortable with Google building a profile of every search that you've done over a 10-year period and then storing that as something that they can access based on your
status? Let's ask the audience right now.
IP address.
Show of hands on that. Does everybody think that search companies should keep all searches indefinitely on everything that you've ever searched on? How many people think it's perfectly reasonable and that that allows the search engine to get better and better and better? Pardon me? Well, assume disclosure, don't assume deletion. Okay, show of hands on that, 3 or 4 people. How many people think that Google should, at some point, just eliminate all of the searches and start from scratch, like after a couple of years?
Okay, and I've got, may I ask a question? Here's my question. Let's imagine, I've got, you know, it's fantastic. You look at Google, this extraordinary company. If you were worried, and I could create another search engine that perhaps wasn't quite as good, but let's say for the sake of this it was as good, but my one competitive advantage over Google is I didn't store it, are you going to move away from Google? Do you care enough? You know how Google works, nice simple interface and all of that. Is privacy enough for you? It's a bit like cars. You didn't used to be able to sell cars on safety. Now you can sell cars on safety, but 20 years ago everyone said, you know, what's Volvo doing? You simply can't sell cars on safety, and now you absolutely can. Today, can I sell a service where my competitive advantage is privacy? Well, and it's clear you can't.
No, I agree with you. If there are two search engines that are exactly the same in terms of quality, and one of them has a privacy policy that people like and one of them does not, I think that that would be a trade-off that some people would make. But then you would say, as coming from The Economist, how would they do business? You know, how would they be able to make as much money so that they could compete with Google? And I think it's a legitimate question.
Or rather, I'd say it the other way around. If it turned out that the market forces says, yes, now this has become the issue, Google would change their policy within
Right, so this is
weeks.
My point, right? You know, if it's the case that people see a disclosure and they come to understand, you know, this is a really big problem and it's happening again and again, and people who are, you know, not doing nefarious things, you know, this is not like how do I murder somebody kind of searches, but, you know, just everyday people are time and again getting harmed by this, then there would be a change in the market, and all of the search companies would react to
they
that,
would.
Not just one.
They would.
However, until we get to that time, if you said to somebody, would you stop using a search engine in order to protect your privacy, everyone would say no. There is right. No one who would say, like, I can live without search engines.
I think we've seen I think it's sort of a false question to say, you know, is privacy enough of a differentiator in today's marketplace? What we have certainly seen is that trust is a differentiator. If you have a brand that consumers trust,
sure,
then you will generate more business. And that is sort of a soft thing to assess, but it is very, very real. And privacy is certainly a piece of that. The other thing that we have seen is that there is enormous downside potential. It's difficult to assess the ROI of privacy, but if you screw it up, it certainly, certainly can hurt you in,
sure,
in a very, very big way.
You can see that in Gator, Claria.
Yeah. In the DoubleClick example, in ChoicePoint, in case after case after case, not only in the public markets and stock price, but in consumer engagement with the brand.
I think the other thing that's interesting is actually that hit that we would take as companies if we stopped collecting most of this data is actually relatively small, because most companies collect all this data but do absolutely nothing with it. I mean, the reality is the technology that's required to do something with this data is far too complicated, not so much because the algorithms are complicated, but because the processing power is complicated.
Sure,
and
but
secondly,
it's analogous with search engine capabilities, right? So that particular market has the technology to do more with it.
I think we've made a couple of interesting analogies today, and the one that I like particularly is the environmentalism analogy. I think that we are on... In the very early stages of sort of a data environmentalism, that we are driven right now by those Exxon Valdez moments when data spills and you know, we have to go wash it off of birds on the Alaskan coast. We see it in the media. We see lots of stories about privacy. But it's going to take us some time to get to a point to recognize that our data lives within an information economy, an ecosystem that needs to be protected. And certainly I see us on that trajectory, but just in the very early stages of that.
You know, one thing we haven't talked about in that environment is since 9/11 in this country, the focus on privacy has largely been around civil liberties and the governmental use of data as opposed to the commercial sector use of data. Right up until 9/11, that was the hot debate, was around commercial data in this country. But I think actually here and in Europe as well, the debate between data retention for law enforcement and the need for greater access by the government to commercial databases has become a more dominant conversation. And we just touched briefly on the concept of behavioral targeting and in sensitive areas. And Trevor, you might want to just describe what that is for people, make sure we all understand that. But I wonder how people would feel if they knew that a profile was being built on them that related to their health or their sexual orientation or other sensitive areas that advertisers might be interested in, but then would fall into the hands of the government through a subpoena process or any other law enforcement process?
So it's kind of a big question, and it raises issues of anonymity, pseudonymity, and personalization, as well as behavioral targeting. Generally, behavioral targeting is the process of observing web traffic behavior, clickstream, across a network of sites, associating that with a state management tool, generally a cookie. Sometimes it's a downloaded client on the client side. And aggregating that data into some form that becomes actionable. So you are shopping for a car. People within 2 weeks of starting a search for a car are at their apex of their flight in terms of actually purchasing something. So it's a great time to deliver banner ads on new cars to them. That's very valuable to a car advertiser. So building that profile and making it actionable for marketers is what behavioral targeting is all about. It's also related to the fact that 7-8 years ago, I worked at a company called Engage. We were a big ad server and a behavioral targeter. And back then, you really couldn't give inventory away. CPMs were abysmally low for online advertising inventory. Today, online ad inventory is more of a scarce resource. And so if I can get just a carpet bombing CPM of X, but then if I add behavioral targeting to it, it's 2X, well, if I can generate more revenue for that same real estate, it's more valuable to me. So as a result, there are a number of companies, a whole bunch of companies actually working in this behavioral targeting space today. It raises important questions, though, about what what is okay for that behavior? What is okay for that profile that we can target upon? And again, that line is very, very difficult to draw. I think we could all say, okay, if you're shopping for a car, you know, that's probably one of the most marketed categories in the world, and that's okay to target. But when we get into health and finances, sexual orientation, you know, personal life, individual life, things get a little shakier. We were trying to discuss whether there should be some lines in the pharmaceutical world the other day, and we were trying to figure out where that line might be. And we're saying, okay, well, if it's a prescription, then it shouldn't be targeted. But, you know, what if it's a prescription just for acid reflux disease, indigestion, right? Would we be embarrassed about that? Maybe, maybe not. We were trying to draw a line between over-the-counter versus prescribed drugs. And we said, well, you know, there's a lot of stuff that would be embarrassing that's over-the-counter. You know, you can imagine all sorts of things that could create challenges. Does that mean that, you know, Tylenol can't target people based on pain relief? There are some very, I think, interesting questions that are going to have to be answered in the months and probably a couple of years ahead that we just don't have really good standards for right now.
So I think what you're saying is correct, that there are different approaches for different kinds of markets. You know, Andrew, you were saying earlier, could you create a market for something on the basis of privacy, which is exactly what I'm out to do with my company. And I think that, you know, there are differentiations between markets. Your bank building is probably built out of marble, but your corner store is not built out of marble. And the reason is because the security of the bank building matters a lot more to you than the security of the corner store. And you can take that analogy to privacy that, you know, all right, if I'm just, you know, reading blogs, I don't really care if people know that I'm on this blog. But if we're talking about really sensitive financial data, then my standards are going to be a lot higher, and I'm going to evaluate the business differently than I would just some other business.
The other interesting risk when you think about sensitive behavioral targeting is getting it wrong and having a persona online that's not really reflective of who you are. And I think we've all had that experience on sites, you know, where there's a lot of personalization, and some sites do it really, really well. But sometimes that algorithm just doesn't work. And I've had my own experiences in companies like Amazon. If you make a purchase and a rush order, multiple copies of a book, boy, that scores you up high, and that's going to stay in your profile for a real long time. And I think that we're obviously in the infancy of this world. But what I'm wondering, when we think about the way the world has evolved and the way the targeting's going, and those personalized profiles, is there a generation gap that's evolved? Are there a group of customers out there who take it for granted this is happening and really are not that concerned, the MySpace generation and others who are saying, hey, I want to put my whole life online, I really am not concerned, and is this a conversation that is going to recede over time? Or is this a conversation, I think you just said, we're at the very beginning of, and it's going to become more and more intense? I wonder what the panelists' thoughts might be on that.
I think it's a hard one to call. I'm sure you're right that the under 20s, perhaps, and perhaps many of the crowd here who are perhaps a bit older than that but are more like under 20s, are on the one hand more tech savvy and able to deal with it, but on the other hand much happier to have the most extraordinary things online that people like me wouldn't. But in terms of the conversation, I think that this is a conversation that's actually dying down. And, you know, I've been living this for 10 years or so, and it feels, even though, and perhaps because of legislation coming in, that people feel that they've made enough fuss and that there is laws to protect, I think the overall trust has actually gone up. And certainly from where I sit, the conversation is dying down, and I think that as long as the community of people who provide services to you as consumers remains with some integrity, I think it'll stay died down. I think that in a year's time, or 2 years' time, you won't be having a panel on this.
I disagree on that point.
Yeah, I think it completely depends on the outcome of history. The plumbing analogy holds for me. If people see breaches that are continuing concerns to them, I mean, I still talk to people who know all about ChoicePoint, even though they had no reason before that breach occurred to have any idea who ChoicePoint was. They still know who that company is, and they still make purchasing decisions based on it, even though it's years later.
I would disagree that the debate's going away. I think the debate may shift. It may move towards consumer trust, but I think certainly this debate has had only growing significance and breadth in the marketplace over the past 10 years. And I don't see that abating, particularly because of some of the security breach issues. One of the most interesting things that we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years is California introduced this fairly simple law. And all it said was that if you have a security breach of sensitive information, and that includes social security number or credit card number, from an unencrypted database, you have to provide notice to all of the people in that database that their data may have been compromised. So this very simple idea of giving people notice if there's a compromised database has now multiplied to over 25, I think it may even be 30 states by now, and there's a real debate in Congress. And what we are finding is that there are lots of these data breaches, and consumers are increasingly becoming concerned, particularly when they get a notice and they don't know what to do with it.
But I don't think that's a privacy discussion. I think that that's a security discussion. And you can say, oh, it's kind of the same thing, but fundamentally it isn't, because we said that this was all about ethics, this discussion, and it was all about this trade-off and no free lunch. And I get that, and that's the debate that I think is going away. The fact is, do I want my sensitive data to be kept securely, and should the technology companies be looking at that, and should legislators be looking at that? Absolutely. But that is a fundamentally different discussion from the discussion about the ethics and the trade-offs of no free lunch.
I think it's a different but parallel discussion. I think they are intertwined very much. So security speaks to how do you protect the data, privacy speaks to what do you do with the data. And as much as we are seeing the debate rise about how do we protect this data, how do we bake security in, we're also seeing the debate continue to froth and boil with regards to how do you use that data and what is appropriate use of that data.
So I totally agree that security threats and privacy threats are two different things. But what happens when you have a security breach is that oftentimes people will learn what private data was kept in that database in the first place.
Right.
And when they learn that, they become much more sensitized to, well, how did that get there?
And they
can cause further security and privacy breaches too. If I have your social security number, maybe I can impersonate you and from that learn more about you.
Mm-hmm. I always like to say, and the security team in my company wouldn't really necessarily agree, but I always say security has to be the handmaiden of privacy, in the sense that you really cannot have privacy without that adequate level of security. And I think that this is an area where in many companies the two teams start to work much more closely together in recognition of that. Well, I don't want to end the panel without ample opportunity for questions. And so I'd just like to pause at this time and see if there are some questions. And if there aren't, we'll go on with our conversation. But I'd just love to see if you folks we've covered a lot of territory, if you'd like to add into it.
I work for the Globe and Mail, which is a newspaper in Canada. We've been struggling with the privacy rights and registration policies and how much information we share with that registration with the advertisers. And we've struggled and come to a rough compromise. But what struck me with the debate was that there was no one in-house in charge of privacy. I mean, newspapers have ombudsmans. Is it a chief privacy officer a trend that the panel thinks might be emerging, or is it needed at all?
Well, in a statement of full disclosure here, I'm the executive director of the NAI and I represent the online advertising world, but I also concurrently serve as the executive director of the International Association of Privacy Professionals, and we are the world's largest privacy organization. We represent privacy professionals. Diane is a member from Microsoft. And the rise of the privacy professional has really been astonishing over the past 5 or 6 years. Our organization is 6 years old. We started with 300 members and $30,000 in the bank when I was hired 5 years ago. And we just crested 3,600 members, and our conferences are attracting 1,200 people at a time. I think we have seen the profession of privacy really become entrenched. And really start to grow. And not only are we seeing Fortune 500 companies appoint CPOs, but we are seeing the privacy function move out and down within organizations. So usually the CPO is the first step, where the privacy director or privacy counsel has all sorts of names. And then it's almost like the joke for small businesses is when you hire your first lawyer, your legal bills go up. You find that there's a lot more to do and deal with regards to privacy in your organization than you may have suspected at first. So that may be that idle hands make lots of work, too, and a privacy professional needs to justify their existence, so they find all sorts of issues when they step in the door. But certainly we see CPOs as a very common response to many of these challenges. And as national laws, best practices, technological innovations emerge, the level of knowledge and sophistication necessary really is creating a profession. And then the one layer on top of that are the global data transfers. And as Peter Cullen, the chief privacy strategist for Microsoft, said recently, what's not global anymore? Data flows all over the world, and that creates jurisdictional challenges as it flows around the world, particularly as it goes through Europe.
I think that it's sometimes good to have somebody that's at the top of a particular function like that, then if it all goes wrong, you can fire them. So that sort of gives you an out. But on the whole, I think it's dangerous. There is clearly a branch of law. It's complex legislation now. And as Trevor says, it's global. So it's really complicated. So you kind of need a legal side. But actually, when you go into business and you take people in marketing and you take people in technology, the last thing you want is privacy. What's that? Well, it's what that person does. And I think that actually there is this danger of identifying the person, in that everyone then says, I don't have to worry anymore. We've now got somebody who deals with that issue. And I think we saw it with business continuity planning, disaster recovery. We kind of saw a similar thing, whereas if you say we have a department that does that, so nobody themselves has to worry about those issues in the businesses, I think that's actually rather dangerous. So yes, I think there is a role for the very narrow specialist lawyer, but actually for those people that are not so much, as I say, you get my view about privacy, but for thinking about how you should be dealing with your customers and what is the right thing to do with advertisers, you can't separate that and put that in a room with a room number and job title.
And I think that's a very common structure, actually, where you have a chief privacy officer or a privacy champion within your organization, and then they have a liaison relationship to a lot of other places with responsibility in a business area assigned to a particular person for that business area, although they don't have privacy in their title, and it may not be 90% of their job, but it is a part of their job.
Are there other questions?
We were talking before about youth. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
We've seen the FBI go into search engines and say, hey, give me your data without a subpoena. Where is the line drawn when somebody comes to your company and, for the government and says, I'd like to, just get a dump of all your data, and, where do you, I don't see it in most privacy policies. Where the line is.
It usually is in a privacy policy. You should, if you read a couple, I'm sure any of the ones of folks here on the stage, it'll say, if presented with a valid subpoena or in response to a legally justified request from law enforcement officials, we will release your data. I think the big question, the big issue for organizations is what do you do when it's coming through a non-subpoena request, which was the debate we had last year on this. And for that, my recommendation is lawyer up and make a decision for your organization about what makes sense. Last year, we saw, three big companies with data requested. Two of them said yes, one of them said no. And you could make, I think, balanced and rational arguments to support both results. But certainly you need to spend a lot of time looking at your privacy policy and thinking about the consumer fallout and also the request, what the purpose of the request for the data is associated with.
So, I think there's a point in what you just said which is really important, which is that Google responded differently than Yahoo and other companies about how to respond to this government request. And one of the requests was this totally ridiculous, meaningless request. Give us 1 million web addresses You know, any Perl programmer can write a one-line Perl program to get a million web addresses. It's public information. But because the subpoena said, we want you to give this kind of information, and Google felt like it was not the right thing to do, they fought it. And, you know, in this other case of the Chinese dissident, Yahoo decided to comply with the Chinese request for data. And whatever the facts of those two cases are, the Google case, the information request was absurd. Just like there was no reason why the government needed to request that data. In the Yahoo case, it's clear that there are issues on both sides of how they made that decision. But the perception of those decisions has been really important. Maybe not in the marketplace, maybe not more people are using Google and not using Yahoo because of those two decisions. But certainly with recruiting, I mean, I see people who will go and work for Google because they believe that the stance Google took in that case was the right stance and the stance that Yahoo took was the wrong stance. So, you know, if you look at, you know, a business as a whole operation, not just how are customers behaving, but how do you recruit the best talent? How do you have sort of a press perception of what you do? Even these totally meaningless subpoenas or requests can have a very significant impact on how the company is perceived.
Mm-hmm. Just in the interest of disclosure, we looked at that request very carefully at MSN and that you're referencing, and the request was for a set of search results, not for individual results tied to an identity of any kind. So when we complied with that request, and we stated this publicly, we gave just those raw results, which have no way of being then fashioned back or associated back to any known customer. And so it got a little bit, the perception in the press didn't, that was a nicety that got a little bit lost. But the fundamental point, which is should companies make individual decisions about where they think those lines are, that's absolutely true. Each company needs to decide if a request is legitimate, and if so, how to respond. And as to where it's covered in a privacy statement, I was just going to switch over, but I don't want to mess up this whole thing. I can offline get to you and show you exactly where it is. And in most privacy statements, there's a paragraph or two that describes this. And again, it is legalistic sounding oftentimes, so you go right past it potentially. But
the 12th grade
level. But basically, yeah, basically, you know, we at Microsoft would never respond without a full legal authorized request that would come in, whether it was a U.S. government or a foreign government. In other words, it's not like someone just randomly ever would knock. It's not an informal process at all. It's quite formal.
I think it's interesting. You know, in my profession, or not that I'm a journalist, but in the world in which I work, as you know, journalists protect their sources, and they'll do that in the face of just about anything. And it's interesting that rule of thumb is what you need in many cases. And I think that is the reason why they do that is that they believe that if you didn't protect your sources, journalism would kind of go out of business, because actually if people didn't believe they were safe in saying the things to journalists that the journalists need to tell the stories, and that is a fundamental part of the freedoms that we all enjoy, comes through the freedom of the press. That's the journalistic story anyway. I think that part of what you're seeing in that discussion is actually brings back to the slightly murky nature of what we're talking about here, because if we believed that, I mean, I think the case of the Chinese dissident was kind of interesting, if we believe that the internet is a source for good and all of that, that actually and what we do as companies through the internet has some value, then I suspect some of those rules of thumbs, regardless of the law, need to come into play, and I suspect that the angst that we all go through is telling us, when these subpoenas come in, is telling us something. And that what it's telling us is that we've probably got it wrong, and that actually I suspect we should be saying no more often than perhaps we currently do. And I think that regardless of what the legal outcome is.
So I would also say that you know, I'm a big believer in Larry Lessig's book Code is Law. You know, the way that you write code has implications for the way that people are governed. And I, you know, at Wasabi, our approach has been to not keep associations between a unique individual that can be identified by email address or username or public name and their transaction data. We don't have any association between those two things except when you're logged in. And there are techniques for doing things like this that we think help at least have the owner of the data or the holder of the data not be able to comply with the request at all. And if you can create a system that's like that, then these questions of, well, how do we decide what to give them become much simpler. We don't have the information. We don't need it to do our business. And therefore, we don't have to comply with the request because we can't.
I'll give one final note on that comment that Andrew just said. I agree that companies need to balance it. And unfortunately, again, the popular perception is, well, that was the time people had a choice. And in fact, things come up all the time. And, you know, the vast majority of times, those requests are denied. And so, I mean, it's very hard to, and we don't want to talk about that all the time, but it's very hard to get, I think, a true picture of that environment right now, sure, because it is shrouded in those conversations between, legal requests and lawyers at different companies. But it is a vital, vital question that you put your finger on.
But, I mean, you know, you don't hear about it, but there are always conversations about sales tax fraud, or VAT fraud, as it's called in the UK, all businesses get approached all the time to when there is sort of stuff going on about fraud and identity fraud and all sorts of things. So, again, I suspect a little bit that the internet and search engines in particular, for one reason or another, get an undue spotlight on this, and that actually it's something that we deal with all the time in business.
Well, with that, I think maybe we'll let you out early. If our panelists have any last thoughts, that I know sometimes you're something you wanted to mention and you haven't, I give you all an opportunity to close on a thought, and then we'll end the panel.
Sure. No, I mean, I think that the idea of privacy, I mean, it's very hard, as Andrew was saying, to market based on the idea of privacy, and it may not be a worthwhile effort to do that. But I still think that as a technologist, it's my responsibility to create technologies that are not harmful to the world and the people in it. So I hope that even if Andrew is completely right, that there's absolutely no market benefit for doing it, at least if we're doing the right thing and we build a good business that way, that's the right approach for us to take.
When my youth, I used to write legacy systems. They were, you know, legacy as they fell off the end of the fingers. And actually getting data across databases to reconcile and to aggregate is actually very hard. And I think that actually if you in the technology world can actually find ways to aggregate that data, you'll have made a huge step forward in itself.
So. I think it's all about trust, and I think privacy is a huge component of that. And I think there are enormous benefits to be gained for organizations that focus on building a trusting relationship with their customers, and a big part of that is doing the right thing by privacy. And a big part about doing the right thing with privacy is making sure that you've got the people and the knowledge and the brain power on staff to answer those questions, because it is a very sophisticated area from a legal perspective, but also from an operational and practical perspective today. So there's lots to do in this space, and I think there really will be champions in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank the panelists and thank the audience.